Hallo, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer einer weiteren Folge der Interviews for Future des Podcasts der Scientists for Future Leipzig. Heute auf Englisch. Hello, dear listeners to our podcast Interviews for Future from Scientists for Future Leipzig. My guest today is Dr. Amanda Power from the Faculty of History of the University of Oxford. Hi, Amanda. Nice to see you.
Hi there.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I'm very, very curious about what will come out because your research in general is mid-ages. That's right.
That's right, yes.
But you're still interested in climate change too, and you're building bridges between those, I would say, in the first moment, far away things or topics.
That's right. Although, of course, there was climate change in the Middle Ages. And the Middle Ages is a foundation for how we think now. So I think it's very important to have earlier periods in the conversation.
Okay, so yeah, we had this small climate change. This was the regional in around about the mid-ocean, mostly, I think. Is this what you mean? Or?
Well, I guess what I mean is the climate. There were shifts in climate right throughout the medieval period. So in some ways, it's quite interesting for studying societal reactions to both warmer and colder periods in different parts of the world.
Okay.
That 1,000 years.
First for the beginning, how did it came? Is you started being interested in mid-ages and then kind of the climate topic or vice versa? Or how does it came together for you personally?
Well, I did start as a medievalist and for a long time, as you say, it didn't seem very obvious how what I knew as a medievalist could be particularly helpful for my equally great concern with climate matters. But then, because I'm a historian of the development of thought, a lot of what I was doing seemed to me to be laying down the foundations for the sort of thinking that I believe is hampering climate action now. And so I wanted to build on my expertise in the medieval period to show where these ideas had come from and just how deeply rooted they are in our societies. They're not just modern ideas. They don't just come from industrialization or from the 20th century. They're much more tightly built into how we think over many, many centuries.
So in general, the way we are thinking, talking about things and so on in these kind of modern times and modern thinking, there's much more close to medieval thinking as we know sometimes or as we want maybe. So maybe some Christian influences in our thinking and being or like this.
I think so. I think so. And of course, what we would call medieval, what we would call Christian thinking is really part of how medieval power worked. So it was an elite ideology that was used in very extractive ways quite often. So I think we can't see it as a pure kind of spiritual thinking that runs through the period and doesn't touch what happens.
Is this maybe spiritual thinking is a very big thing? So yeah, there are differences because you had in the mid ages and before a kind of fight between spiritual thoughts, like there's this one God and this one God has the power and has to say how it is, like Bible, like Catholicism and so on. And on the other hand, you have these use the little gods of the nature and so on. Is this something you'd say, okay, let out please the spiritual part in general today? Or is it maybe you would say, okay, let's have a view on the other side that's so covered from the Christianist side? Or how would you talk about this?
Well, I think it's more that I would like us to understand how we came to think the way that we do think, rather than necessarily wanting to pull bits out of it and say this is what we should still be thinking on, this is what we should return to. There's a big debate amongst medievalists that's been going on for a long time about what pagan thought would have been in Europe in the early Middle Ages, so the sort of thought that's associated with people who are said to have worshipped trees or rivers, often in areas like Saxony and sort of central Eastern Europe before they were taken over by Christian kingdoms. But the problem is that we don't have particularly good information about it, because all we know is what the church said about it. So I think what we can take from that isn't so much that there are ways, you know, ways of worshipping trees that we could bring back, but more how is it that the church is using the idea that some people worship trees as a way to talk about what should really happen, which is not to worship trees. So I see it as a sort of, as a way of formulating a kind of rationality that says the more rational thing is to believe in this one God that we administer from Rome, rather than having whatever kind of close connection it is to your local environment that might be summed up as worshipping a tree. So I think the point is we don't know whether people in those regions had these close connections with the environment, but it seems that this is the sort of thing that the church doesn't like and tends to characterize as pagan.
So concrete something about of having power in the end. So having power about people, they are not easy to control if you let them live like they want with nature and so on. And as we have today.
Yes, I mean, I think if you, I mean, this is a bit speculative, but if you have a very immediate love of your very local environment and you care about it, and that's where you get meaning for yourself and for your family and for life, then it's very hard to get you to do anything outside that environment. It's hard to make you pay taxes to someone far away. It's hard to get you to get involved in wars that you know, that have nothing to do with you. So I think it's about centralizing people's loyalties into something larger. So a lot of historians have seen this as important for founding Europe. So it's created a kind of centralized ideology that everyone in Europe can identify with as all Christians. But at the cost, I think, of it being okay to have very, very kind of close identification with local landscapes. And I think what we have to bear in mind is that once the church had gone in and converted people and warlords had taken over the lands, the thing they did was to cut down the forests and to extract metals from mines. So you have this very devastated, deforested mined landscape quite often. And it's hard to see how, if people had a very strong local connection, it would have been possible to get them to feel that this was all right.
I had a discussion with a guy from South America 1 week ago, and it was like he said that many of these movements, that climate movements and environment safety movements, that they are very, very, very deeply in their culture, and yeah, they have the culture is combined with the nature. So in Germany, I don't feel this anymore, that our culture is in any way combined with nature. So maybe this is one of these things.
I mean, I think I have drawn on writing by people in South America in particular, and Australia, who often anthropologists are working with indigenous communities and writing by indigenous people themselves to try and think about what might have been lost in Europe. I would hesitate to say that we know for sure that it was that, because we can't really know. But I think it's an interesting speculation that sort of thought might have been the thing that was the target of the church, particularly because these kind of narratives about the irrationality of being too close to ecosystems, you know, living in forests, that sort of thing, transported so easily to the New World and was used so effectively against local populations there.
You researched something that brought me to ask you for this interview. That's from my side a bit very, very interesting, because maybe very affecting in this climate scene. We have here in Germany, it's like this, that most of climate scientists, if you talk private to them, they say, yes, we have to do this, that, and so on. But I'm a scientist, I have to be neutral. For my personal opinion, I would divide it two parts of neutrality. For sure, my research, I have to look neutral on it, but my will to make research is not neutral, and my will to change the world with it maybe is not neutral. It's okay. You looked deeper in this from what it came.
Yes, because I think that's, you know, as you say, it's a problem that everyone who's an academic researcher who's concerned about these issues has to face. What do we do with the things that we know? Do we have to produce them very, very neutrally and hope that other people will understand what we're trying to say about the gravity of the situation and act on it? If we don't allow ourselves to act on it, we're then dependent on being able to communicate it well, which is often something that academics aren't trained to do well. So what is it that holds us back from from being able to directly engage with what we know. And I mean, one of the explanations that I have put forward for that is that it's a very old technique for making academic knowledge sit at a remove from the public sphere. And I think one origin for it in the West, at least, is medieval monasticism. So in the early church, there's a very strong sense that so all knowledge comes from God. So all knowledge is in a sense holy if it's true knowledge. And so in order to get closer to true knowledge, you need to be as perfect as you can be in Christian terms. And so that is achieved by separating yourself from all the things that are seen as sinful and human, and trying to make yourself as close to a sort of disembodied mind as you can. And so this means taking a vow of chastity, and often about trying to live in forms of poverty. So you still had books and the sort of things you needed to study, but you weren't supposed to have luxuries of any kind. You're supposed to fast and not eat particularly kind of delicious foods. You certainly weren't supposed to be having children. If you had them, you were supposed to not help them particularly in life. These are all ideals. I'm not saying this is exactly what happened. But there's a very strong sense that in order to get close to this perfect knowledge, in a sinful world, you had to do it by trying to be as perfect as you could be. And there's a very Christian set of ideas of what perfection looks like. And so if you've got most learning being done by mostly men who don't have children and don't have partners and aren't engaged in all the daily work of you know, food production and sexual relationships and I suppose all the things that come with family, and also disruptions and being invested in one's children and their life and their death and their health and their future. This idea of detachment, something that pulls you very far away from the sorts of things that are meaningful to most of us. And the further away, I think the part of the problem is the further away you got, the more wise and the more pure your thinking was supposed to be. And so there's a continuum and they're very kind of extreme people on that, the end of it, who really mortify their flesh all the time and are thought to have a particularly unique insight. And anyone who is a bit too corrupt in one way or another is seen as, you know, who interacts with kings or who advises people or who comes up with opinions about what should happen in kind of local places or places that matter to individuals, they seem less authoritative. So authority is on a continuum and it's not just what you know in terms of reading books, but it's also the conduct of your life. And so I think that this very strong sort of ethos about what produces good knowledge is kind of maintained over the centuries. I mean, people don't have to keep on thinking that, but they keep choosing to think that. And by the time you're in the central Middle Ages, when the universities are starting, people are, I suppose they have the option of going out into the world a bit more because these aren't monastic institutions anymore, but they keep trying to maintain the idea that particular kinds of moral purity make you know better. So the Franciscans and Dominicans come to dominate a lot of the thinking in the universities, and they're trying to live in poverty as well, and they're also celibate. I'd like to emphasize the fact it's a continuous choice over time, and when people do get too engaged with things, there is one of the best effective lines of pushback is you're supposed to be unworldly, you're supposed to be pure, you're not supposed to be getting mixed up with kings and their policies. And so it's partly self-policing, but I think it's also insisted on as a sense of if all knowledge comes from God, you have to be close to God to access it. And I think that we tend to assume there's a big shift around the time of the Enlightenment or maybe even the Renaissance that changes things. But that sense that you need to be, if not celibate, certainly a man who has a staff who's looking after children rather than doing it yourself would continue through the professionalization of universities in the 19th century. I mean, most intellectuals are kind of comfortable men who aren't having to engage in domestic life very much. And I think as we move into the 20th century, 21st century, there's a sort of similar idea, the idea that you would be an academic with a family and the family would be there visible in your academic life is still a little bit questionable. It's very recent that was possible.
So you have a bit the point that maybe you have these those I would say a kind of medieval nerds in the end, and they were used a bit as tools. So if the knowledge comes from God, and these nerds, I would say, are the bringers of this knowledge. They bring it, they have it then, but they are not the users of it. And you have for sure a big in society more powerful part of God close people. That's the rulers in the end. So the lords and so on, and the Pope and all these. So if I bring this to today's time, is it a bit that we have the same, but now it's not God and the church. Now it's economy and making money.
I also wonder whether it's something to do with how we think of scholarly objectivity, because I think it's actually very much the same sort of ideas that the more dispassionate you are, the better your research is. And so that sense that only through what we imagine as a kind of perfect objectivity can you do really credible research. And of course, the whole thing's an illusion, because no one's objective like that. Even computers and AI are not objective like that. They're programmed by someone. So it's a sort of, because it's such a fantastical idea that one could be totally objective, it does seem to me to be rooted in old ideas of a sort of single unified knowledge that can only be accessed through sort of mechanisms of disengagement. And of course, there's a lot that's important about that, about scholarly objectivity or trying to discipline yourself to be objective when you're working. There are certainly various types of ideologies that we would not want to be affecting scholarly research. I mean, the sort of academic racism of the 19th century, for example, would be one thing that we would still want to insist was a sort of subjectivity we don't want in the universities. So it's a slightly uncomfortable argument to be making, in a way, that we should revisit the question of what scholarly objectivity is doing.
If you brought in the children and the family as a part of those thinkings you have to look on. To go a bit more in the practical view, so we have something to solve and we don't have any time. It's climate change and biodiversity crisis. So what would you say a normal scientist who is maybe on this point is like, yeah, I'm researching those things, but I don't go too far with my voice, with loudness or bringing out.
I think what we need to do there is to look at the people who would rather not take academic work seriously, because it in an ideal world of the kind that we might imagine we're living in, if a scientist uncovers something compellingly in the way that everything that we know about climate change, it's now so tightly demonstrated in every possible way that there's no doubt. But of course, as we all know, there are very organized groups of people of various different kinds who are trying to cast doubt on it for reasons that we all understand very well. And I suppose the question is, who is it exactly that chooses not to listen to science and to, if not discredit it, I think we've moved past the point where discrediting is the main strategy, but the main strategy is now, all right, yes, it's happening, but economically it makes no sense to act on it. And all sorts of crazy ideas that are very well funded, and because I think most of the public know intellectually that they should trust science, because we're a society that says that we're science-based. But these arguments about how scientists should conduct themselves and these arguments that make science small in the scheme of things are very attractive to people, because people don't see how to transform the world. So the scientists say this is happening, we need to act fast, but it's not clear what to do. And so people would rather think, okay, well, yes, the scientists are saying that, but the government isn't acting on it, and the big companies aren't acting on it, and, you know, here's a new car that's being advertised to me. And so there are so many other voices that try and make science a very small part of the conversation. And they're not scrupulous about talking, whereas the scientists are scrupulous about talking. So it's very easy to become minimalized as a kind of a voice in the situation, when ideally the scientific voice ought to be almost the only voice that's telling the truth. Does that make sense?
Maybe the point, I think the voice of science is very, very different to other voices. So if I have a politician, maybe he's more the oil friendly, fuel friendly, and not so deep in those things, maybe. And you have a 16-year-old boy, girl with maybe colored hair and says something to this person, he will say, okay, yeah, go to school, goodbye. But if there's someone from science, maybe a bit clear, it's clear there's the person who made a kind of career in science. This is a very deeper influence into society, or in those people, maybe as example. But in society is listening with wider ears, wider open ears. And I think maybe that's the way of how to, because on the other side you have to listen. Whom you are telling something, this principle of the receiver and the sender receiver, and for me personally, I think that mostly in this climate part that scientists often forget who is the receiver or who has to be the receiver, and the receiver, the most important receiver, I would say are those people who are. Somewhere in between believing there is some climate change and believing the deniers. So this is the group we are fighting about.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the things that's happened with the way that science has been presented is that scientists are supposed to be objective and disengaged, as we've just been saying. But then at the same time, that can be used against them. So they can say, well, you're only a scientist. What do you know about the real world? And I think this is where the economic arguments are used against science. So they say, well, you don't really understand, like, well, it's impractical to say that we should do this. So it's almost like attacking a monk for being in a monastery and not knowing how things work. It's a kind of old strategy to say, yes, all right, you're right scientifically, but scientifically is only one way of knowing. And so I think that the kind of people that you're talking about who are open to persuasion, but who need to have something to get hold of, it's possible they need to see scientists speaking across a broader front so that it can't be thought that the scientist only knows the lab. Like that, even in a sense, the humanity of the scientist is a helpful thing to bring into the foreground. And I think that scientists have tried to do this by saying, I have children, I'm afraid, as well. There's a lot of a talk on quite in quite strong emotional ways, but maybe less talk about I too need to drive a car, or we're all caught up in a capitalist system, or those sorts of things that are maybe the sort of mundane and yet the most powerful thing stopping ordinary people from feeling as if they can engage with this. And I think the other difficulty might be that when you speak from a pure scientific position, people aren't. I mean, maybe it's different in some countries, but certainly in the UK. The school scientific education barely equips people to understand what's being said to them, really, the physics or of it, or even, I mean, I'm not sure how many people are taught about ecosystems and biodiversity, or how agriculture actually works, or any of these things that would help them to understand the complex nature of the challenges that we're facing. And so I think that being able to bring these different elements into the picture in ways that are easily understood is perhaps quite an important way of communicating to people just the breadth of the trouble. I mean, I think people perhaps, I don't know, perhaps think of scientists as talking about melting icebergs or, the kind of big streamlined kind of ideas that have been popularized, like polar bears and rising oceans and things that are quite hard to understand. But because scientists have been removed from talking in terms in sort of economic and human and daily life terms,
yeah, that's what I say.
I don't know whether that's how it seems to you as well.
This is kind of living in this high tower of science with less contact to the real world and the real people's sorrows. But I think maybe it's possible to come back. It's for sure scientists can show in which way ever that they are part of this real world. Maybe going to demonstration or like this, going there visible, or maybe taking their children with them. To some interview. So they say, okay, I'm not only here as a scientist, I'm here as a mother, as a father. And every mother, every father knows only by hearing, I'm here as a mother. So, okay, you changed clothes full of mud, and you do this. Those, it's very close to real world then, with only a few sentences or a few steps, and it's difficult for sure. For it's maybe a very very interesting difference. I don't know, between Germany and England and Great Britain. That maybe the kind of the society talks about those things could be different. We have in Germany the same, that scientists are a bit in their tower for sure. But there are a few things I wouldn't go with you, because maybe it's here a bit different. So it was maybe a bit too far away. But we don't have a worldwide known universities. You have them in England. So maybe it's there a bit different, or...
I also think in England at the moment, there's, or in the UK at the moment, there are pretty active political and media forces that are working in ways that I think are more extreme than in Germany, that are working to make this, make it very, very hard to get a climate message across. And the BBC is a problem, because for a long time it's had this idea of balance, which has meant collecting lots of opinions regardless of whether they're worth talking about or not, and trying to get a center ground between them.
So you mean,
and that's
you mean,
treated as the most respectable way to talk about climate change, even though it's been very harmful.
You mean this kind of balance that you have 999 people say it's clear climate change, and then you have one it's not, and both get 10 minutes in TV.
Yeah, exactly that kind of balance.
Unbalance in the end. Yeah, this we have too. It's what do you think about those? We have in Germany, you have in UK surely too, some kinds of groups. They go a bit from climate groups, they go a bit far away from only demonstration, only talking, interviews and so on. It's as two examples. One is called Aufstand der letzten Generation. It means resistance of the last generation. They mean themselves, because we are the last generation who can change it or not. That's young, mostly young people, and they are blocking streets. They are making many blocking actions. And this is discussed in Germany very, very different, ambivalent, because some people say, and in the climate scene too, some people say, okay, they are only giving pressure to the wrong people, making bad publicity. Other people say they make the publicity of how crazy this problem is. For my opinion, there's an easy solution, and we have them. It's worldwide. I think maybe in Great Britain too, it's they call it the Group Scientist Rebellion. They are scientists. And they do those things too, a bit more on the point. Maybe if there is some politician going this street later, then they block this street, exactly this street. And the funny thing is, they do what scientists normally not do in their work. They are wearing white clothes that's for everyone visible. Hey, these are scientists. What do you think about those things? Or maybe what have your idea about what's happening in England?
I think we're having, in a way, similar sorts of arguments. Today, in fact, was the day when, no, was it today? This week, the bill that the government has been passing to make it illegal to have a protest that makes anyone uncomfortable, that's come into force. And so the police can now arrest you for making anyone uncomfortable. And this is, of course, designed to shut down climate protest, because, you know, it makes people uncomfortable to be told these things. And it's a little bit unclear how that's going to play out in practice. So far, I think they've only arrested someone for protesting Brexit. But it is designed to give power to shut down that sort of protest. And I think that's partly in response to the Insulate Britain protests, which were blocking the motorways a few months ago, with a demand that all the houses in Britain should be insulated, which at the moment most of them are not. But the thing is that protest did get insulation being discussed in the media and amongst people. So it's very hard to say. I think that a similar line of argument that we've been discussing is used to try and discipline protest into the most anemic form possible, so that it doesn't trouble anyone, it doesn't get into the newspaper. So then newspapers can choose never to talk about climate at all. And I think that the people who say, well, those protesters made me think that I hate all environmentalists, probably already hated environmentalists. I mean, it's not a it's not a sane response to say I don't care about climate change because someone blocked the road. So I feel that the very negative opinions that get a lot of coverage are a bit selective. I think maybe other people start talking when they see the protests and start thinking for themselves a bit.
Yeah, and maybe then you have this situation that you talk about maybe the negative way about the protest, maybe joking about funny climate change not existing, and 2 months later your own house gets flushed away from a flood. So, and then later comes the thinking and the connection to, hey, oh, they were right, maybe.
Something I've been thinking about more recently is what other ways of doing it might look like, and somewhere between telling scientific facts in what might seem a dry way through to protest in the streets. It sometimes feels like there's not very much between those two things. And so
maybe making papers with scientific facts somewhere in the streets or like this.
Yeah, and that it's almost one thing or the other. If you're a concerned academic, you can either try and publish academic papers or you can be in the streets, and it's hard to imagine what else you might do. But I've been talking quite a lot to the people in my own university who are working on various aspects of not just climate, but also food systems, and thinking about the ways that humanities and social sciences disciplines can perhaps now move into this space and produce different stories, different narratives around what's happened and why it's happened. So, for example, I think one of the big problems that we have is that climate change often seems like a thing that either will happen in the future or is starting to happen now, but has nothing to do with the human past. So it's a sort of shock. So up until now, we were having progress. We were going to the moon. We were becoming in command of nature. We had, you know, we were now, our food systems were under control. We had little to fear from the disruptions of natural forces. And then suddenly the natural forces are overwhelming us again, and perhaps we're facing extinction. And these two stories there's just a big gap between them. So the stories that people talk about when they think about the human past is a kind of long narrative of improvement of everything. And then why is it suddenly all going wrong? That's the bit that people don't understand. So I think they don't think about the going wrong. They just look around them and, you know, things are mostly still working unless you're unlucky enough to live somewhere where it's not. And of course, in Europe, it's easy to say, oh, if it's happening in the global south, it doesn't matter so much. But if we had a different kind of history, if people were taught that over centuries, this kind of extractive nature dominating behavior has caused more and more anthropogenic change to the planet, and increase, and as we scaled up with fossil fuels, that the same ideas are the things that are causing the problem. So all this has been going on for a long time, and everything that we've been taught was an achievement now becomes a bit more ambiguous. You know, it's maybe an achievement, but it's also got costs. So if you start telling the human past with the story of the costs visible rather than hidden, then I think people can perhaps begin to see this as not a rupture and not as something that doesn't fit with their view of the world, but something that actually is an inevitable consequence of everything we've been doing for a long time now. And that's just one example. I'm a historian, that's how it seems to me. But I think that people in working in literature think about climate fiction and other sorts of stories that help people imagine more vividly.
So a bit bringing out this point, because we have had this world catastrophe all the time. It's called the apocalypse from the Christianity, and all the time it's told, okay, the apocalypse is coming and you can't do anything. So is this, you would say, something we have really, really deeply as a society to change these, or is it maybe a result of those times that many people ignore climate change and la la la, and that they have this deep cultural feeling there comes an apocalypse now and we can't do anything because everyone tells us all the time?
I think, yes, I think that's, it's interesting that in the past when people were talking about the apocalypse, they almost always were talking about it to try and make people behave better so that the apocalypse wouldn't come.
Yes, yeah.
So and in a way we're doing that, the same thing now. It's a very established cultural trope, you know, that we will, you know, humanity and many other life will go extinct unless we become better. It's always the same it's the same kind of narrative pattern in a way. But what I meant was something a little bit different from that. So if you think in terms of how we've made money over many centuries, if you, instead of saying this, this enlightened king introduced coinage so that the economy could work more smoothly and look at these interesting coins with his face on and you can date them and look, they start being exchanged and people buy these things with them and look, the economy grows and there's now a global economy and people are trading with China and coins, you can find these coins distributed everywhere. And so that's a kind of story that is excited about capitalist exchange. But supposing you added to that story what it looks like to mine for the metals that are being used for the coins and the levels of lead pollution that the smelting process is causing and the really astonishing amount of deforestation that's involved in pre-modern mining methods. And you didn't only tell that story, but you didn't only tell the capitalist story. You put everything together so that you can always see that the things that you do have their consequences and that you so that people come to understand that consequences come along with the thing. I think that what we've been doing is telling histories that only show the improvements and that hide the cost, like economic externalities, like the cost that you choose not to see and you choose not to account for. So I think that that's one way of just helping people understand that, you know, that the modern global capitalism has this shadow world of huge environmental costs, which we're not told about.
Yeah, so maybe as an example that you use today things you never seen how they were produced, how they were thrown away. We are not connected to that what we are doing. So buy a cloth from China and throw it in the waters of Africa. So in the end, and in older times it was much more close. So if I throw it away tomorrow, I don't have a shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how to do it? It's because in the end, capitalism is fighting exactly against these clothing. So if I have a clothes, if I have the shirt I wear at the moment, if I have a close feeling to it because I repaired it and so on, I have it maybe 10 years and then I don't want to have a new one. And the same with a washing machine. I don't need a new one if I can repair it or if it's a very good one. So it's completely, it's good, but it's against capitalism in the end, because capitalism do the opposite. So
yeah, I mean, I feel that all these things are pretty desperate struggles at this stage, but I in order to remain optimistic enough to keep trying to think about what we could do, I like to think with the idea that, you know, it's in the IPCC reports that even though we're now locked into a certain amount of temperature rise, just how bad it is to some extent still a product of ongoing social choices. And of course, there are tipping points and all the various other possibilities that would negate these sorts of actions. But I think we can only do our best where we are. But I also think that people's minds can change if they have different information and more of it. And if it becomes I think that the thing that the fossil fuel companies anticipated in the 1970s was that there would come a point where it would become impossible to deny that this was going on. And then they would need different strategies. So they're very well prepared for how things are now when it's no longer possible to deny what's happening and who caused it. But I think for the rest of us who haven't been thinking quite in those terms, it is now, should be recognized as a dark opportunity, but an opportunity when it's now hard for most people to see that this isn't happening. And as you know, in the not very many years to come, I think it will get even harder to close your eyes to it. And maybe then people will want to understand better. And it seems to me to be a little bit of a race against time, because we can see in many countries this authoritarian turn as money goes into producing, as fossil fuel money goes into supporting much more authoritarian political figures who, as has just happened in England, want to shut down public dissent. So it seems to me there's still time now to try and make different ideas go around. And it seems particularly urgent to do it, partly because of what's happening to the climate, but also partly because of the fast-changing political situation and this kind of turn to sort of right-wing authoritarian fossil capital governments around the world.
So maybe that's a bit metaphoric told. So if you have the all the things we have to do to solve climate problems, the problems they are there and so on, a bit covered by a like kind of shape. And the most climate action people from science, and not mostly from science, try to uncover it. And try to uncover it, and try to uncover it, and it's very, very hard to uncover it. But so it sounds for me a bit like that would be not a bad idea to more get in the direction filling the covered part with more clear things, because climate change will uncover it itself surely in the next years.
Yeah, so. I mean, to my mind, I think it already has. I think the public conversation's changed a lot. I think before the pandemic, it was already beginning to change with the school strikes and things. It's not clear quite what's happened with that now, but I think more people are aware of it, but I think that they don't know what to think about it. And so one possibility is to lay all our hopes in transformative technologies, which I suppose is, you know, maybe people who are concerned now by electric cars, even though that has its own environmental costs. But I still sort of feel that in the world of ideas, what's still missing is how to think about, so the scientists give us information that's frightening and galvanizing, and then you don't know what to do next. Like, what do you do next? Do you buy an electric car? So it's that kind of steady work from maybe a greater collaboration of different academics in different fields and other people as well, about how to, you know, what goes in that space? What is it that people can think about? And I mean, even thinking about what's happened in the past, you know, the societies that are in trouble have various different ways of acting. And it seems to me, for my children, the future could be, well, it might be awful, whatever happens, but it could be a time where societies to some extent try and come together with some notion of climate justice. Or it could be a time where it's just awful in dystopian ways. And these are still choices that can be made if people have ways of thinking about sharing resources. And again, I guess this is pushing against a lot of the sort of neoliberal individual kind of fighting for themselves against everyone else, sort of dog eat dog ideas. But can these ideas, can people come to understand these ideas as the root of our problems rather than the way to react? And there's interesting work from people like Andres Malm on white supremacy and fossil fuel capital and how they're very closely allied. And it might be a way in the for the kind of white supremacist right to kind of comfort itself that it, at least there will be the, you know, the last people left standing. But if the rest of us don't want that, then maybe this is a time to kind of recognize that societies always have choices about how to behave, even in the worst possible times. So maybe, those kinds of ideas.
So maybe you see a kind of future that is with a worse economy, a worse environment, but a better humanity in the end.
I mean, I suppose that's probably the best possibility on the table at this stage.
Yes.
I don't know how realistic I think it is, but I also think if we work to make the ideas there to have.
Yeah, at the moment it goes much more in the direction of war. It's so stupid, as you see. That this week the NATO decided to give much, much more money for weapons, not for Ukraine but for themselves. And but if we have a clear thing, there's Russia and the NATO, and Russia has 60 billions every year, and NATO has the hundreds of it. So we don't need any tank more as NATO to buy, but
exactly.
So this as I've thought, for sure, it's sure that comes war comes like this, that the first effect could be like this. The same maybe you've heard about that Germany wants to invest 100 billion euro in our Bundeswehr, in our army, to resist against a maybe Russian attack. It's stupid. We have NATO. So it remembers me a bit. I'm not historian, so maybe I'm wrong, but it reminds me a bit of this, that when the pestilence came and they started to slaughter the Jews. So it's a non-solution solution.
We should perhaps not just think of fossil fuel capital, but also the military industrial complex, which were also in America particularly, I think, were very quick to realize or quick to accept what the climate scientists were telling them and to act on it and to, you know, to plan accordingly at the same time as denying it publicly.
Is there maybe another example from historic where it not swapped in this way, where it swapped in the better way, like not pushing the problem away and making some difference, like slaughtering Jews or buying much more weapons, where we can say, okay, humanity is possible to act smart?
Some of it's sort of speculative, but there, it's one of the things that medieval historians are very interested in is what happens after the fall of the Roman Empire. And for a long time, that's been seen as a sort of collapse of civilization into a kind of barbarism out of which emerged European kingdoms a bit later. But some of the recent thinking has been suggesting that perhaps once extractive empire goes away, there's a kind of maybe a rewilding, but also that communities maybe become a bit smaller and maybe become self-governing in ways that are could be better for the people living in them. And there's some archaeology that suggests that people seem to be healthier in this period and skeletons were bigger, suggesting that kind of ordinary men were taller after the Roman Empire finished than before, when they were kind of effectively enslaved working on in big plantations for Roman aristocrats. It's the problem is that a lot of the, so one of the other accusations against the pagans is that they have egalitarian decision-making processes and they don't have single rulers, and the missionaries, the monks who are writing about them, think that this is terrible, this is bad, like worshipping a tree. It's also bad not to have a clear leader and not to have a hierarchy. And so again, we don't really know whether that's how things actually were for those communities, but it's possible that what we're seeing is the traces of kind of locally invested communities that have more egalitarian ways of living that might emerge in times where central government's less strong. And I think that certainly what we don't see is that kind of dystopian Wild West stuff that we, you know, the sort of Mad Max world. Yeah. That's not what's happening.
Yeah, that's good to see in a movie, but not to live in.
Indeed.
Interesting. I would say we can talk a few hours longer, but that's maybe not the time. So if there's something I missed, or maybe you really want to bring on the table, so if it's maybe you want to greet someone in Germany or bring some topic on it, or like you want, so I will give you an open slot now.
Well, I suppose I'd just like to come back to the ways that I think that humanities and some of the, I mean, many social scientists are already, I don't know whether this is the same distinction as in Germany, but that many of the disciplines that haven't been involved in at the forefront of talking about climate, I think it would be good for scientists to invite people working in those areas to join in trying to think about ways to communicate beyond the academic world and to communicate and to build ideas about society so not just us telling science in an easier to understand form, but everyone together thinking about what might happen and how to make it happen in better ways. Sort of ideas about human tipping points that Tim Lenton in Exeter has been talking about, you know, how do you make these human tipping points better? So those kind of alliances seem to me to be quite important to try and build, if we can, just to broaden the base of people who are working on this. And in a sense, not to leave the scientists alone to have to deal with this by themselves, but to have more support from the rest of the university community.
So if you call yourself a scientist for future, you don't have to be a natural scientist. You have to be someone from the academic world. And yeah, this sounds good. It's a good ending. And so thank you very much for this interview.
Well, thank you. Thank you.